Good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and it's great to have everybody joining us again here as we roll into the end of 2016 and the beginning of 2017 as we record this. Hope everybody is safe and preparing for the end of the year and maybe some holiday activities safely. Of course, the queen of safety, my esteemed co-host, is on. So, hey, Sam.
Hey, Jamie. My idea of safety is not going out of the house.
Well, as cold as it is there, I guess not.
We were at the end of our cold snap, fortunately. It's supposed to warm up all the way to 40 tomorrow. But I got up this morning at 7 o'clock, and it was -2. So I said, we're going to stay in the house all day, which, of course, I did. It's nice that it's easy for me to do. So how are things back there on the East Coast? Is it getting cold?
Oh, yeah. All that cold weather that you had is, of course, moving across the country is that dip in the jet stream kind of slides on across. And so, yeah, it's cold tonight. It'll get colder tomorrow and it'll be cold again on Saturday. So.
Well, and the interesting thing is our Colorado weather tomorrow will be about the same as it is in Memphis. And that doesn't happen too often, does it, Dr. Joe?
No, it doesn't. It's cold down here. We're in the 20s tonight and, in the 40s tomorrow and another cold day tomorrow, but no snow or any of that sort of stuff.
Well, that's good. So far, anyway, it's early.
Do you get a lot of snow, Joe?
Yeah, no. I was just wondering that, actually, when I asked the question.
No, it's pretty unusual. We tend to get an ice storm every few years, maybe a little peppering of snow just a bit, and that's it. Generally, the winters here are very short and very mild.
And you're happy with it that way, aren't you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yes, looks like our friend Kevin in Texas. He's very happy to never see snow because he was born in New Jersey. So, so Jamie, there's been all kinds of weirdness going on in the world of disaster. Fortunately, it hasn't turned out to be a worst-case scenario, but there's earthquakes popping up all over the place.
Yeah, right off the coast of California, Northern California, there was a small earthquake that they weren't predicting any major things, but they did feel it in some seaside towns in Northern California and Southern Oregon. But the biggest thing was there was, for a short time, a major tsunami warning in Hawaii because of a 7.8 scale quake in the Solomon Islands that they were fearing would cause some problems. They eventually looked at it and how, I guess, they can tell which direction the quake rolls or whatever. So they were able to determine that the quake wasn't going to direct the waves at any landmass that had people in it. So they removed the tsunami warning, but it made a few waves that were maybe, six inches to a foot higher than normal. So that's not a big deal. You get that with a heavy wind. So,
well, and it's good that the systems are in place to give out the warnings. Better that they cancel them later than they don't know at all that it might be coming in and be another high soon. And, as they had a couple years ago. So that's not a bad thing.
Yeah, well, no, that's why these early warning systems are in place, is to protect people from these types of events. And as we'll talk about later on as we visit with our guest about revisiting some things about Hurricane Katrina, it's that advanced warning that gives systems the opportunity to prepare and additional systems to prepare to come in and help out if needed. And the same thing is true in the Pacific Rim, where they have a very sophisticated tsunami warning system all the way around the entire rim of the Pacific and the islands in between. So it's something to keep an eye on. But again, some seismic activity on the day we recorded this. And it just goes to show that, preparedness is important, and monitoring and being aware of what things could be occurring in your region is important to understand. So we talk about that a lot, but it bears revisiting.
Oh, just about every week we revisit it because there's something else happening, whether it's a wildfire in Joe's part of the woods or a tsunami. There's all kinds of different things. But, talking about New Orleans and Katrina, I'm taken back to being in New Orleans with you guys a couple months ago. And, of course, Dr. Joe was involved in USAR during Hurricane Matthew. But one of the things we learned is how well prepared New Orleans is now based on what they didn't know prior to Katrina. And that's kind of a good lead in. Dr. Joe, I'm going to have you introduce your guest because I'm really excited about this. And that's one of the topics we're going to talk about tonight, but more on an administrative level, which should be interesting.
Sure. Well, I am very happy to introduce a dear friend and colleague, Dr. Gillette Saucy, who is renowned in EMS circles, quite honestly, for her contribution over the years. And, you know, I hope we get an opportunity tonight to have a couple of different conversations. As you mentioned earlier, Sam, Dr. Saucy was the EMS medical director for New Orleans Fire at the time of Hurricane Katrina. And I thought it would be interesting to talk to someone and get a bit of a perspective of what it must be like when all the resources are coming straight at you in a lot of different ways. So with that being said, Juliette, welcome to the program. We're so glad to have you.
Thank you for inviting me. It's a privilege.
Well, that remains to be seen, but we certainly hope so.
Juliette, would you like to just share a little bit about your background so people can get a sense of a little bit more about you?
Sure. I actually started my career as an EMT and trained as a paramedic, and much to my parents' chagrin, took off from, I was a Tulane college student, and took off a year to complete my paramedic training, and then post-graduation decided I would go and work for the city of New Orleans as a paramedic. So you can imagine parents who'd put you through college, they were expecting me to do something different than go work for the city. But I did, and it was some of the most amazing years of my life. I subsequently went on to medical school and at LSU Medical School in New Orleans, did my residency at Charity Hospital in emergency medicine, had my children during medical school, and you know, was boarded, and then stayed on as faculty for 16 years, making a recent change, well, recent as in four-ish years ago, moving up to Northern Virginia. So my heart, my soul, my entire, you know, love, I guess, is EMS, and I've been able to do that in multiple areas and multiple situations. So, yeah, that's a short version. I was blessed to be trained at Charity Hospital. I'll just put a plug in there for an amazing, life-changing experience of being able to serve the underserved and poor and learn in a city that was, you know, much like the old, quote, knife and gun club, but clearly a very violent, racially motivated city, and continues to be that way today, but an excellent place to train, sometimes a sad place to live.
Well, if you can handle that, you can handle just about anything, anywhere, I would assume. And, you know, on that note, too, some of the best ER docs I know started out as EMTs and medics and came up through the ranks, and I think it gives you a whole different perspective as a doctor, especially an ER doc, when, you know, you've been there, done that, been on the streets, and you really kind of appreciate what goes on out there.
Yeah, I'm not one of the docs that's like, why didn't you do X, Y, and Z? It's more like, tell me what happened, because, you know, clearly I've been in every or almost every circumstance you can be in. So the whole judgment of not having been in your shoes doesn't exist. But that doesn't mean I don't hold people accountable for, you know, their performance. And having been the director and medical director, it was actually for New Orleans EMS as well as New Orleans Fire and the Department of Homeland Security in New Orleans. It gave me multiple avenues to be able to utilize my experience to provide the leadership and the guidance that I think is absolutely inherent in any high-performing system.
Well, and it's funny because, you know, we medics always talk about our careers and waiting for the big one, and you had that happen. So what was it like, as Joe said earlier, when it hit the fan and all of a sudden you have all these resources coming in? And like I said, you said you're looking at it from two different perspectives, which makes it even more interesting.
You know, perhaps my training in EMS allowed me to roll with the punches. And when I say roll, that was with a lot of bumps along the way. But, you know, I'd been director and medical director for 8 months. I'd been asked to take over a failing system and try to make it work in a government that didn't necessarily appreciate what we did. You know, we were kind of an afterthought buried in the health department. And then Katrina hit, and, you know, we did our planning. But the truth is, in retrospect, given where we are now, we weren't prepared. We tried to be prepared, but you can only be prepared as much as a government allows you to prepare and support you. So I don't think, you know, when you find out on Friday night when you are the host of, you know, EMS Today, that there's a Category 5 hurricane barreling down on you, and you find out the next morning at 6 a.m., oh, by the way, it switched courses, and we need you in the mayor's office. I mean, that's not the 72-plus hours you need to prepare for a major disaster. So admittedly, we were not prepared, despite all the models, despite the Hurricane Pam simulation models of Katrina or the worst-case scenario. Nobody really believes it until you're there. And so we got an up-close and personal view of what it feels like, A, to be not prepared, B, not to have the resources, and C, to be completely honestly have our knees taken out from under us with no communication, no real plan, with all due respect, I would have to say the federal government was not prepared for this. So it was a catastrophic failure on many, many, many levels. And my only hope is that we are somewhat better today than we were then.
Well, that's what we understand from talking to a lot of the fire folks and EMS out there, because they use that as a learning experience. And it would seem to me from afar, and not having been down there, that, you know, even though there were models that suggested this level of disaster could occur, whether it's the public or the administration, nobody really thought it could happen, especially the secondary event where, you know, the levees failed. I mean, that in and of itself was a whole separate disaster that just made the whole thing worse. So, you know, what were those first few days like as you start to slog through what is actually happening and what needs to be done?
Well, you know, in our little organization, which at the time was fairly marginalized, I mean, fire and EMS and police were very, very separate entities. Fire did provide first response, but I would not say that the relationship was extraordinarily integrated. So the first few days were, what's the word? overwhelming. I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, at the time, I'm not sure I felt overwhelmed, but it was like, it was literally like living in a almost a twilight zone.
Alternate universe of some kind.
Yeah, I mean, we have no, all our units are either underwater or on a bridge that's covered by water. Our 911 system at 23:23 on Sunday night was closed. Have any of you in the community ever had your 911 system shut down so that no more 911 calls were being taken? Because we had no assets to send. The winds were too high. Frankly, every emergency room had closed. So we had nowhere to transport people. And with that knowledge, responding to a call made no sense. So it was the most eerie just all eerie. What's the word?
Situation.
Gut-wrenching, Twilight Zone sort of feeling to say after a consultation with the fire chief and the police chief to say we are shutting down 911 operations. It was, I believe, a once-in-a-lifetime thing, and it was a vacuous, awful, hollow feeling to hear people calling and us say we can't send anybody. So it was very, very emotional.
I can imagine. Joe, can you conceive of anything like that happening in Memphis?
I can't, quite honestly. I mean, we're so dependent on those systems, and we're so accustomed to those systems being operational that, the idea of how do you function when your complete infrastructure has been taken out from under you is just, above and beyond. And I know you guys spent a couple of days in probably sheer chaos, not being able to sort of move or do much of anything. And I feel fairly confident that you were not getting an awful lot of direction from city, county, state, and federal leadership there on how to get you back on your feet. Can you spend a couple of minutes sort of talking about that and maybe just a bit on sort of what it was like when the resources kind of started showing up and maybe not even the resources that you necessarily wanted?
Sure. And Joe, you know me pretty well. So the idea that you were, quote, paralyzed, even though the practicality may have been that we were, the frenetic sort of activity was we're not. And my real focus, and as we sat there and oddly enough, and it's not happened before or since, as we sat in our headquarters that morning, we actually were in a huddle and we actually prayed, and our prayer was not only would we survive and that all of us would come home, but that we could save as many people as possible. And that was a very odd, I mean, I've left for work, as have you all, 100,000 times, never ever considering that I might not really come home. And so leaving that circle with the idea that we would all be okay. So that became the pursuit, once it happened. And once I had told my children goodbye and hoped that they were in a safe place, it became about when we realized, okay, the storm has passed, and we were like, wow, okay, the storm's passed. This is good. And as we watch out the window and the water's rising, something's not right. And it was very clear when the new sheriff came over and started talking about the women taking over the prison and the flooding and the breaking of the dams. And I'm looking at my deputy director going, is this for real? And we're both, it is for real. It became really about making sure that we were okay. And we had a very intricate plan where we were divided into five areas of the city to take care of each area, understanding that each area would be self-sufficient. But at that point, it really became about being accountable for your people. Are my people alive? Are they okay? Are they sustained? And when it becomes that kind of Darwinian sort of survival of, are we just getting basic food, water, et cetera, that's a whole new level that I'm not sure many of us experience, and I'll never forget it. But it's very, very real. When the pleas began, and the number of times I climbed, the nine floors to the, quote, EOC and said, we need help, only to be told there was no help, calls to the Surgeon General, God love him, Richard Carmona, what an amazing man, who said, I have no assets. I'm like, seriously, Richard, I need your help. But finally, just finally walking and reaching out and finally finding the general, honestly, General Honoré, and saying, that we are beyond, and our first encounter didn't go well. That's another story. But finding out that, you know, after meeting with FEMA, that it wasn't in their, quote, playbook, which, as you can imagine, on day 4 or 5 of no sleep, Joe, you can imagine, not my finest moment. You know, finding somebody who said, what do you need and where do you need it? And saying, this is what I need and this is what I need it. So the initial kind of perfunctory response of, yes, FEMA's coming and yes, the National Guard's there, but not really able to get anything done was incredibly frustrating. And then finally meeting, you know, the three-star general of, you know, the Army who came in and said, we're going to get this done, was, you know, uplifting and hopeful and all of that. So it was a very tumultuous sort of roller coaster ride of emotions that went on.
Well, just from the my federal perspective, and of course, Joe, as you saw, and I'm a DMATter, and our team went down 3 separate times, had actually 3 separate deployments down there. The first one was at the Superdome, which wasn't the best experience. The second one was at the airport, airlifting people out. And the third time, they were assigned to one of the hospitals that was sort of semi-functional to help them get up and running. So it was pretty crazy for the federal assets, too, because like you said, it's just so untamed. There was just so much going on, and people were upset because they weren't getting what they thought they needed, and everybody's in fear, and it was crazy. So, Joe, were there USARs down there as well? I'm not really sure about the USAR response to Katrina.
Yeah, actually, you know, I think Juliette just described probably the most austere of austere conditions that we've ever talked about. I'm not sure I can even fathom what she was experiencing over those couple of days. But to your question, Sam, there were multiple USAR, FEMA USAR teams that were pre-positioned all along the Gulf Coast. There were either 4 or 6 that were in Louisiana and, you know, just sort of awaiting direction and that sort of stuff. And, you know, we're on the ground fairly quickly afterwards. But of course, I think the ability for us to connect with anybody that had a sense of what was going on was severely impacted. And you know, to me, that's one of the most profound issues around that Katrina response, is that I don't know that I've ever felt any more isolated than when I was working there, just because as we talked about earlier, the complete infrastructure was decimated. And so, you know, nobody even knew we were there doing anything, much less being able to assign us to places where perhaps we could have done more than we did. But Juliette, I'm curious to know, as those resources begin to sort of appear on your radar screen just a little bit, what was it like to try to provide some feedback to the system and get the system kind of back on its feet again? Can you talk about that just a little bit?
Sure. I think, you know, as the pieces began to fall together and the assets became visible, and I can't make a big enough plug for the federal assets to tap into the local resources, because that is just absolutely invaluable and creates an environment where I think we're highly functional. And that was missing. So I had no idea you were there. You know, I ran into ICE. I ran into wildlife and fisheries. I ran into random people that came in to help. But I didn't have a direct connect to the resources that we needed. So when it was elucidated, when they were there, I mean, we were much more able to, you know, to act on our mission, to be aligned mission-wise, to have a playbook, to talk, you know, leaders talk to leaders, here's what we're going, clear direction. Here's our mission. Here's our goal, et cetera. I mean, that was, you know, uplifting, heart-filling, the whole deal. And it was sparse, and it was not consistent, and it was awkward and, you know, ungraceful. So my only hope is from all of that, that we, you know, then my only hope is that somebody learns from this and we get better. And frankly, when Gustav came for me in New Orleans, we had created a city-assisted evacuation plan that involved all our federal partners, all our local partners. And the evacuation, even though the impact was not what was expected, the evacuation was fairly seamless. So I know it can be done, which is you know, a rare opportunity to be able to relive something and realize we can do it right. So to your point, when help shows up, I think what was missing back then was we had this whole idea, and you've heard me say this a million times, so bear with me. We're the federal government. We're here to help. Mm-hmm. You know, look at your shoes. You're wearing loafers. You're not there to help. You're wearing boots. I got your back. Let's talk. So when you absolutely, you know, when you're there and you're integrated in, provided that, and we were all, and acknowledging the fact that we were all victims of this. So I was unwilling to accept that I was a victim of anything, even though I'd lost my house and my dog. I had no idea where my kids were, you know, et cetera. I was unwilling to accept that I was a victim, but the truth is I was. And in any disaster, the local folks, in most cases, are impacted very heavily by the disaster, whether it be a terrorist attack or whether it be, you know, an earthquake, et cetera. Your local infrastructure is weakened and brought to its knees. Even if it's not physically and infrastructure-wise, it's emotionally. And we really, really, really count on those external forces with their fortitude and their insight and their supportive compassion to be able to uplift the locals to help direct the response, because frankly, none of us, whether it's me or you going into a community, I don't know. I need somebody at my side directing me so that I impact the community in the way that they're accustomed to. It's not about taking over. It's about joining forces.
Well said.
Yeah, and you know, Joe, we did our segment with you on the Hurricane Matthew response. And I'm just curious if you could juxtapose how you felt about integrating with local resources when compared to what we just heard Juliet describe in those initial days after Katrina.
Oh, that's a great idea, Jamie. I think that we've come a very long way from the days of Katrina. I think at the same time, Katrina was probably the storm that had the deepest and most profound impact on all of our systems. And, you know, if you can live through that one, you can live through any of them at this point. But there were certainly many, many lessons learned. And I think as we listen to what Juliet had to say there, we really appreciate that. The concept of, you know, sort of resource management and communication and partnering and having those things in place ahead of time make more difference, I think, than they're often given credit for. And just simply the idea of knowing that there's somebody out there that you've made contact with before and you can reach out to and don't have to do that on the fly and know who it is you're talking to and know what it is they can do for you can enhance that ability to respond to incidents like that multiple fold.
Yeah, that kind of, thanks. I mean, Joe, that kind of leads you back to the old adage, you know, you have a Rolodex of people, and we, you know, we're very fortunate to have this incredible depth of connection in the EMS medical direction community, but, you know, don't let the day something happens be the day that you pick up the phone and touch base with the very people that you are absolutely going to need in your foxhole, because that you need to build those relationships. And that's very touchy-feely in some ways. I cannot emphasize it enough. But I know with every bone in my body that if something happened now or in Memphis or what in any place, that I could pick up the phone and in a heartbeat, what do you need? And I'll be there. And I believe that there's no doubt in anybody's mind, and I think back to Houston and how, when they were being, I believe it was Rita, they were being hit with. No, it couldn't have been Rita. It had to be a few storms later. But I'll never forget our colleague Dave calling me in the middle of the night. What are you doing? Are you awake? It was like 2 in the morning. I'm like, yeah. And he goes like, no, you're not. And I'm like, I am. What's up, man? You're calling me at 2 in the morning. Like, okay, we're getting ready. What, you know, I might need this. And I'm like, got your back. I'll be there. My folks will be there. Whatever we can do, we will do. And there is nothing more sincere or true or calming or loving than that. And sometimes that sounds very, again, very, not effeminate, but very esoteric in some ways. But that is what you need when it's gone to hell in a handbasket. I need to know that I've got some really strong folks in my foxhole, and they'll be there no matter what.
Amen.
Well, and Katrina was the event. I mean, when we talk about everything from how things were handled, how things should be handled, the relationship between locals and the feds, I mean, we learned, I would hope to think we learned so many things at so many different levels that, God forbid, we're ever there again. But when we are, maybe there'll be more people having more people's backs. I can only hope.
So,
all you can hope is it will be better, and I believe in all my heart that we will be better. I do have heartburn over the fact that I think we continue to make similar mistakes in certain areas, and I wish that didn't happen, but I think that's probably growing pains.
And that's going to wrap up the first part of this special two-part episode we have here for you with Dr. Juliette Saucy. And we'll be back next week with the second half of this segment we did with her, where we actually transitioned into talking a little bit about her time with the position of medical director in Washington, D.C. And this particular segment coming up next week, I urge you to check in on. It talks about how to deal with leadership in a toxic environment. So I would highly urge you to check that out. We all know that there's been a long time situation in Washington, D.C. where they've had some leadership issues. They're dealing with it and moving forward. But this talks about her particular situation and how she managed it and eventually reached the point where she just had to move on. And we'll talk about that next week. So please come back for next week's special episode on managing leadership in a toxic environment. In the meantime, a special thank you to Paragon Medical Education Group for their very special sponsorship, continued support of the Disaster Podcast. Without them, we could not do this show. And that is very literally true. This episode and all the episodes wouldn't exist without Paragon Medical Education Group's assistance. So make sure you check them out. They are really the one-stop shop for all sorts of disaster preparedness training and education. It is not death by PowerPoint. They call it the experience because that's what it is. And I urge you to check it out and find out more. There's a great video right on the front page of their site at paragonmedicalgroup.com. Check that out. You can also reach out to them at Paragon Medical or Paragon Med EDU on Twitter. And of course, you can always find a link to them directly over at disasterpodcast.com. But please thank them for continuing their support of the show, because without them, we couldn't bring it to you.
That's it for me. I think this episode's really talked about the challenges associated with some of the disasters we run into, and certainly underlines, as Sam says every week, that disaster medicine is not your everyday medicine.